Welcome to Warships Pod, and in this episode, our guest is Captain Doug Littlejohns, who was our guest about a year ago on the podcast when he talked about his career under the sea as a Cold War submariner and also in command of the anti-submarine warfare frigate HMS London. And that included escorting merchant vessels under threat of attack in Arabian seas with its obvious echoes of today. Welcome back, Doug.
Hello, Ian. It's always a pleasure to chat.
It is indeed. To establish the context for our listeners, I'll just outline one or two salient facts. And so today we have Houthi rebels in Yemen attacking merchant vessels with missiles and drones in the Red Sea, as I've mentioned a second ago. And meanwhile, the British Secretary of State for Defence, Grant Shapps, is forecasting that, to quote him, in 5 years' time, we could be looking at multiple theatres. And he means theatres of conflict or confrontation involving Russia, China, Iran and North Korea. Now, to my mind, that is a new Cold War. Some people are panicking and think they're about to be called up into the army and sent off to fight with a bayonet in the trenches. But to my mind, what he was really talking about was a new Cold War and a time again, once again, of East and West confronting each other tensely, but with numerous brushfire or even major proxy wars going on. And we can see a bit of that today. But perhaps and likely not tipping into World War III, as a growing number of people seem to be thinking might happen. So, from the point of view of a Cold War warrior at sea in the 1960s to 1980s, and also working at a high level in the Navy ashore, was there ever a time during that era, Doug, when you feared that it would tip over the edge into the abyss of World War III, which people fear could be upon us today?
Well, to be honest, no. But I'd like to go back on your introduction because Grant Shapps, I'm not quite sure what he's trying to achieve by trying to frighten people, talking about stuff in 5 years. Let's go back to Donald Rumsfeld and his known unknowns and his unknown unknowns. And to start talking about periods of 5 years and so on, it's just nonsense to my mind. And also, one of the unknown unknowns is on the world stage is India. I mean, India's got nuclear weapons and it's having a regular lethal dust-up with China over water in the Himalayas. I'm not quite sure what, other than politics and headline grabbing, what he's on about. But to answer your question about the first Cold War, if you like. I don't think there was ever a point when I was really worried that we would start slinging stuff at each other, although I think it was close in the early 60s with the Cuban Missile Crisis, but that actually polarized minds, and people realized just how close we could have come to something very unpleasant. But thereafter, we had two sides, only two sides. And after Cuba, lots of grown-ups in the room. And so we had a steady state of disagreement. We had MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. It's a completely different world to the one we're now facing with numerous potential enemies. And sort of enemies that you can't really understand what they might do. Just look at October the 7th. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I was a child of the Cold War, obviously myself, and I did have certain fears, as many people did then, but as you say, they likely were not realistic, but I think a lot of people are not in the loop with the reality of, as you say, MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction, and other things during the Cold War perhaps were a little bit calmer. And as you said, there were plenty of adults in the room. But it's also interesting that it wasn't just Grant Shapps. It's almost like a coordinated campaign erupted in February. And the chair of the NATO Military Committee, Admiral Rob Bauer, he's from the Royal Netherlands Navy, said at a press conference after a meeting of the NATO Military Committee that we have to realise it's not a given that we're in peace, and that's why NATO forces are preparing for a conflict with Russia. But he added that the conflict could come within 20 years. And then elsewhere, you've got the German defense minister, Boris Pistorius, who's saying, we hear threats from the Kremlin almost every day. So we've taken into account that Vladimir Putin might even attack a NATO country one day. And he earlier, he told a newspaper that war could occur within a period of 5 to 8 years. And the Swedes, who are providing the Hungarians let them into NATO by approving the membership bid, about to join NATO. And they are also concerned, and they're like the Germans, they're right on the doorstep of Russia. But the thing that we in Warship Sci-Fi and you as a Cold War veteran would say is that, you know, this has been the state of affairs before, where politicians and military have had to manage potential outbreaks of conflict and not have them go over the edge. So I think it's a shock to people now to wake up from the so-called peace dividend era and realize that this state of affairs, which our forebears dealt with a lot of the time, is upon us again. And now they've got to get their game up. So that's the way it occurs to me in having just put together an edition of the mag in which we look at this. But I'm also interested in the podcast in thinking about what it looked like from the maritime arena, and in particular, some of the jobs that you did, because I think although, you know, you're a veteran and you're retired from the Navy, I think there is lots of stuff in history that is relevant today and is worth comparing today with the past. So I was wondering, one job that you did that was very, very interesting was as submarine operations officer of Combined Task Force 311, which was based at Northwood, the naval HQ in North London. And you did that in the mid-1980s. And there was a particularly notable Soviet surge of submarines out of the Arctic. So I think you were mentioning there were a few incidents where it looked like World War III could erupt to those that weren't directly dealing with it. But did you at all fear that the a submarine surge would herald? I know you say you didn't fear it in general, but did you fear that, let's say, a submarine surge from the Arctic might actually indicate something serious, if not World War III, then some other serious move?
If I'd been in that job in the 1960s, and I would have thought it might be the end of the world. But we then went through a period of chess playing, little bits of confrontation, little jabs here and jabs there. And so when I was there, 84 to 85, what we thought this was another poke in the eye for the West from Russia, well, Soviets as they were then. And of course, we were in a much better situation then because I could deploy more SSNs than the Navy now currently owns. And combine that with Turtle Ray frigates and Nimrod MPA, all under one operational control from Northwood. The envy of the Americans, we may come on to that in a minute. And so we felt we could keep a pretty good tab on what was going on. And the Russians, Soviets, they knew that we had a pretty good handle on them. And it was much later when they came up with their better version of SSNs that life became a bit more difficult for the operators. Now, but to go back to your earlier comment about the chairman of the NATO Military Committee, I totally agree with his approach, because since our disastrous swords into plowshares and options for change in 1992, everybody's been sitting back in a nice comfortable chair thinking, oh, it's all going to be sweetness and light from now on in. And it's taking a long time for people to realise it's not.
Yeah. And one of the remarkable things that I find about Grant Shapps is his innate optimism. And he does like to make suggestions that the military, for example, can cope with what's being thrown at them now after that long period of basically disarming the UK armed forces in many ways with a can-do attitude. And one of the most or more extraordinary things that I think he said, which I'll actually quote here, was that he talked about the current government, which has been in power for 14 years. And he said that, and this This is what worries me about them. They seem to live in an alternate reality. He said that over the last decade, this government has made great strides to turn the defence tanker around. And he talks about the refreshes of the integrated review and the defence command paper, and says that they've been instrumental in ensuring Britain is defended in this more dangerous world. We've uplifted our defence spending, investing billions into modernising our armed forces and bringing in a raft of new generation capabilities, from new aircraft carriers to F-35s, from new drones to dreadnought submarines, from better trained troops to the creation of a national cyber force. And he finishes that little bit of his speech to I think it was Lancaster House, which is what I'm quoting from here. And he says, and when the world needs us, we have risen to the moment. And the thing that struck me about that, apart from the fact that it's been, in fact, the opposite of what he says since 2010, especially in David Cameron's notorious defence cuts, the UK armed forces have been hollowed out in several key areas, and capabilities have been abandoned. Certain programs have not been managed very well. But he seems to think, if you take him at face value in his speech, that a lot of the stuff that they're investing billions in, which is years away from actually reaching us, such as the dreadnought class submarines, which he refers to, the ballistic missile submarines, that they're actually useful now, but they don't exist. And it's the same with the frigates, which he was issuing glowing words about in another interaction with the media. So what I'd like to ask you about is, do you think the generation that you belong to and the politicians a bit older than you at that time, do you think that they were realists, and that's why you had the tools that you mentioned there, enough submarines to deal with that Soviet surge, were actually there? Do you think they were aware of the reality rather than the spin?
Well, in short, yes. I mean, the problem with the Shap speech, to my mind, that turning the tanker around aren't nonsense. To go back to Prime Minister Cameron, I mean, I met him in Plymouth in 2010 before the general election. And I made a point of going up to him after he'd given his all wonderful speech to ask him about the state of the Navy and Devonport Dockyard and so on. And he turned to me and quote exactly the words. He said, "Don't worry, sir, the Royal Navy is safe in my hands," which proved to be a complete load of nonsense.
Yeah.
Shap seems to think that if you talk loudly, as Teddy Roosevelt said, it's the right thing to do, but you've got to be carrying a big stick, and
yes,
he doesn't have one. So all this window dressing, and it is window dressing about new ships and new submarines, it's all so far down in the future that many of us will be dead before they appear. And to say that we've stood up, we can stand up for a short period of time, like send four aircraft from Cyprus to Yemen, and maybe we'll come back to that. But that's a sort of one-off, or maybe a two-off, but it's not a defense posture. And nobody's fooled, out from Grant Shapps, it would appear.
Yes, I mean, the big stick that is available to maintain maritime security and world peace, if you like, is the American military, and particularly the US Navy, of course, who you worked closely with, and perhaps we can discuss some aspects of that during the Cold War as well. But today, we've got American and British sailors and aviators in the firing line alongside each other in the Red Sea. And that was aboard the destroyer HMS Diamond, now replaced by the frigate HMS Richmond. And they are integrated with warships of the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower Carrier Strike Group. And they've been shooting down Houthi rebel drones, the Houthis being the rebels in Yemen, who are basically a proxy army for Iran to get up to all sorts of shenanigans, which they've been doing since 2016, firing missiles since 2016, well before the current Gaza war, out into the Red Sea. And how important, I mean, clearly it's important today because without American naval might there in the Red Sea to tackle the Houthi threat to merchant shipping, to shoot down the anti-ship ballistic missiles and cruise missiles and the drones alongside one British destroyer that has been in action, has done very well there. How important do you think, in the past, how important was the relationship between the US Navy and the Royal Navy in facing down the Russian submarine threat? Because maybe there's a few important lessons there. And I mean, you explained to me, and also we are allies and we are in the so-called special relationship, but sometimes the UK and the Americans have a different point of view, which I think we'll probably see again as this Red Sea thing unfolds. But you explained to me for a book I wrote with your corporation and other submarine captains about your lives under the sea, called Hunter Killers, that there was a crucial tactical difference between the Allies and perhaps the British were less aggressive in their mindset than the Americans back then?
I wouldn't say we were less aggressive, but that's quite a broad-ranging question you've posed there. Historically, we worked in the submarine service in particular. We worked hand in glove with the USA. The Royal Navy submarine service was integrated with the US Naval submarine service for operations, shall we say, in northern waters, and from really the end of World War II. In the old days, it was with diesel submarines and then became with nuclear submarines. And we were tasked with the same job, which goes back to your earlier question about surges, and my answer then, because when the West was really concerned that a surge of the Soviet Navy meant something nasty. Yes, but we only had, in those days, when I was at Northwood, we had 27 submarines. It's always frightening when you look at what we've got now. And so we could actually do stuff in northern waters and in the Atlantic to assist the US Navy. The other point about that time is that although we were helping, we had a smaller number of boats than them. So our COs spent probably more time in contact with the Soviets or in the same area as the Soviets than maybe the Americans. And we had two submarines specially fitted out for certain operations. And those submarines spent their whole time in contact with the potential enemy. Whereas in the program I was in, each SSN of the US Navy was sent on one of these patrols, and the commanding officer's promotion prospects depended on his performance on that patrol. So it was quite a different approach by them, because they were trying to get the promotion points, and we were trying to hone the skills that we'd already developed. And there was a quite an interesting quote from my chum, Tom Clancy, when he was talking to a Russian admiral. And the Russian admiral said, "Yeah, we respect all the Allied submarine commanding officers who come up against us. And then he said to the Americans, chagrin, we really fear the Royal Navy COs. That was good, but that was a long time ago.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you talk about the 27 submarines, and because I think even politicians in government today don't understand that 27 submarines does not mean 27 submarines that can be at sea all the time. So that would come down, to 10 that you could use?
Yeah.
So the British, as you said, would be able to carefully target certain jobs for those submarines to do in support of the Americans, and the same today as well. Diamond is only useful, or was useful, in the Red Sea before she took a break, in a particular role, which is the air defence role. And unfortunately, due to the current fit, because as has been well known for years, HMS Diamond has been fitted for, but not with land attack capability. So whereas American destroyers were able to fire Tomahawk land attack missiles at targets in Yemen, Houthi targets, where they were firing their missiles from, Diamond could not do that, despite a very valuable role in the air defense area. But so the relationship between the Americans and the British today, it seems prominently or very imbalanced, I would say, because although we have three ships, two frigates and one destroyer committed to the Red Sea operations and in the Gulf of Aden, there's a limit to what they can do very much because of the armament they've got and also the numbers. The Americans have a carrier and far more ships. So was the relationship during the Cold War, was that more a relationship of equals, or was that imbalanced then as well?
Well, I think in the we're talking about when I was at Northwood, particularly on the submarine side, it was a partnership of equals. In fact, in some ways, we led the field in that we established a one singular controller, CTF-320, it was called, which controlled the SSNs, the Tenere frigates, and, surprisingly, the Nimrods, all under one roof. And that meant we could respond very much more quickly than the Americans, who were engaged in turf wars in Norfolk, Virginia, and other places. In fact, when Admiral Sandy Woodward, who was flag officer of submarines, went over and told his opposite number about our setup, we were invited to go there to Norfolk and tell them how we'd done it and how we'd got over the turf war disputes. That was a good move for me, because that's the trip when I met Tom Clancy. Now, it's a completely different kettle of fish. And what bothers me about our naval standing is that the Americans like to go into any sort of conflict with an ally. And we're always there as a bit of a sort of poodle, really. We're not. I know for the people who are there are doing their very best with the equipment they've got, but we're very much seen as on the periphery, but there to take some of the opprobrium when the Americans come under attack from the media.
Yeah, and it's interesting what you were saying there about the CTF, was it 320, which was an integrated, a way of integrating the RAF, the surface navy, and the submarine. So for listeners that were not totally au fait with it, Todere frigate is, in those days, would have been a Type 22 frigate, with a sonar on the end, and submarines use these as well. But
what's quite often Type 23 sometimes.
Oh, right.
And the Type 22, of which I was privileged to command one, were absolutely designed for Todere frigates, supposedly, but all the machinery was bolted to the hull. So therefore, when you put the Todere out the back, all you got was your own noise.
Yeah.
The Leanders, there was still Leanders who did it as well. Forgot.
Yeah, so the Todere's basically stick a sonar, a passive sonar on the end of a long cable or whatever you want to call it. I called it the electronic sausage when I went to see how they manage those things at Devonport once. And so that means it's away from the noise of the frigate and can hear the Russian submarine. So that's the surface side of it. And then you have the SSN, the attack submarine, the Hunter Killer, is under the sea trying to find and then trail the Russian, if we look at that surge of the mid-1980s, trying to trail that Russian submarine, a Victor 1 or 2 or 3 submarine trying to break out, let's say, in the mid-1980s. And then above, the Nimrod, the Mighty Hunter, the maritime patrol aircraft. So that was an admirable way of combining all those elements, as you said, and ironing out the turf wars. But one of the things that strikes me, this comes back to a little bit to today, and maybe it was relevant, of course, to the past, is that to keep to keep a combination of those things, that trio of capabilities on station deployed to effectively catch, trail, and if needs be in war, destroy the enemy trying to break out or whatever they're doing into the Atlantic. You need enough critical mass in your forces to be able to do it for days, weeks, months at a time. And that is something that I think people, when they look at navies, don't understand, that if something has come to today, if you have 11 frigates, and let's say only four of them are anti-submarine warfare frigates, how long can you actually put one of them out there, and how long for? Especially when one of your anti-submarine warfare frigates that should be monitoring the Russians in the North Atlantic has gone to the Red Sea, because you perhaps don't have another warship available. So how easy was it for you when you were in your job in Northwood to manage that kind of enduring commitment, do you think?
Well, I certainly wouldn't like to be trying to do it today. I mean, you've just outlined some of the problems, but where I take issue with Grant Shapps is phrasing of the can-do attitude, which, all right, so if you go back, British have never been ready for anything. And then if you go back to Dunkirk, that was a can-do. If you go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, that was a can-do. The Falklands was a can-do. But in those days, we had assets. Now we have so few assets that we can do for a week or 10 days or wherever it is, and then we can't. And it does seem that the modern politician just doesn't want to understand the reality behind the speech making. You've now, as you've seen, we've got HMS Diamond has stood down, and we've got a frigate out there. But that's not an air defense frigate. It's the general purpose frigate. We're not plugging a gap in the US Navy's armory. We're there, as I said earlier, to provide allied support.
Right, I agree. And it'd be great to do more, because in previous major joint commitments in Arabian Seas, as I put it, Britain was certainly able to deploy half a dozen or more frigates and occasionally destroyers for the Armilla Patrol, which was the 1980s patrol during the Iran-Iraq War.
We had three at a time out there.
Yeah, yeah, to do that job.
Yeah, and so there room on every two months or so. So that's six times, so it's 18 in a year.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there was the task group in the 1991 Gulf War, which was about 17, 18 ships strong, and there were various destroyers and frigates being relieved during that, 6 months commitment, then coming home. And it was a war, it was up the sharp end with key capabilities with the Americans, the only two navies up the sharp end off Kuwait as the war progressed. And then we had 2003 with the Iraq war, when I think even more Royal Navy warships were committed. So that ability to commit vessels for months at a time and weeks at a time is a key thing. But as you say, there seems to be some kind of problem there with the rhetoric, which talks about amazing frigates, future frigates are about to come. We've invested in them, and they're coming, and they're going to save the day. But and then does somebody then sort of sit Grant Shapps down and say, you do realise they're not going to be here? You know, it's only going to be one or two by the end of the decade, and they're no good now. And you're telling us that we're going to have war within 5 years, so it's slightly crazy.
Well, I think the problem is he just don't want to listen. You know, the politicians don't want to listen. And you remember Philip Hammond, who was Chancellor during part of the savage cuts to the military, said defence is not sexy and no votes in defence. And that's how it goes. And it's quite amazing, really, that defence is now going to be part of the conversation in the run-up to the next general election, because it hasn't been ever since I can remember.
Well, that's the end of part one of our fascinating chat with Doug Littlejohns. And in part two, we'll be looking at Doug's key role in setting out the case for the Trident deterrent program in the 1980s, something which he saw as a staff officer working in the corridors of power. And also, he'll be talking further about the Iranian threat yesterday and today, and also what is it that encourages people to join the Royal Navy. For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at Warships IFR, and also Twitter at Warships IFR. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.